Welcome everyone to Merton and to tonight's event, which from the web I have got as Merton and World War One, but you can see up there there's possibly a slightly different title coming from Anthony. It's a very curious thing that the 750th of Merton and the 100th year from the start of World War One coincide. Of course, in Merton we've had a huge number of 750 events, but I'll go through a few little things that have happened about World War One in college, but not that many. And I see tonight's event, Anthony, as a chance to redress the balance quite a little bit. So the key event for me about World War One was our remembrance service on Remembrance Sunday. It was, as is almost invariably the case, one of those cold, crisp mornings. And they played the Reveille and the Last Post. And while they were being played, your eyes naturally wander up and down the lists, and in Merton's case you tend to stop at the bottom of the list because there you see the two German names, or two Rhodes scholars, Erber and von Wurm, who were, I think, were added quite as late. I was looking at your article, Matthew, 1994, if I read it correctly, so they're sort of quite late additions. And the other thing that caught my eye also about Merton and World War One is we have our annual production, The Postmaster. And if you look in that, there are some 10 portraits and short stories of Mertonians who died in World War One, and they're very, very moving stories indeed. I want to say a big thank you to you for coming to see us, Anthony, today, and coming to talk to us. But especially, Julia, I wanted to say a very big thank you to you for organising this. You don't know it, but Julia must still be in recovery mode from having done the Tolkien Day for us, which she arranged only last Tuesday. So you have a lot on your plate at the moment. And I think that's a very good note on which for me to say over to you now, Julia. But over to you, and thank you. Please give Julia a big round of applause.
Well, I'm really pleased this evening to welcome Professor Anthony Fletcher to talk to us tonight. Anthony started his academic career here at Merton, where he read history. He held a number of academic appointments, and I will just pluck out a few of them. Professor of History at the Universities of Sheffield, Durham, Essex, in succession, not all at the same time. He has also been the director and general editor of the Victoria County History. He's had a number of involvement in a number of different professional societies and organizations, the Ecclesiastical History Society, the Royal Historical Society. And during this time, he was not just teaching, but also producing works of history, showing a great range of historical interest in both the Tudor and Stuart periods of the 16th and 17th century, which led to books such as Tudor Rebellions, A County Community in Peace and War, Sussex 1600 to 1660. My personal favorite, Growing Up in England, The Experience of Childhood, 1600 to 1914. And another book about Stuart England, Reform in the Provinces. So you can see that that Anthony has this broad range of expertise. And tonight he will be sort of combining two of them, because the history of the experience of childhood leading into an interest in maturing into adulthood, and moving from the 17th century into the 20th century with the First World War, and a project that has its origins in a more personal history that Anthony will be talking about tonight. He is not only a historian, but also a benefactor of the library and archives here at Merton, because some of the wonderful historical material that he will be talking about he has donated and has become part of our college library archive special collections. And some of it, just a small selection from a big collection, is now available to be seen in the upper library in the exhibition that Julian Reed, the archivist, put together. And which will be available to view until March. So those of you who weren't able to come earlier this afternoon will get a chance to see it later on. And sorry for that plug, but I couldn't help it. I think now is time to welcome Professor Anthony Fletcher.
Thank you, Warden, for inviting me, and thank you, Julia, for all the organisation you've put into this. And I'd also like to thank particularly at the start Lawrence Carey, who's kindly helped me with the PowerPoint presentation for this evening. Well, in this lecture, I use the youthful life of my grandfather, who was here in Merton, of course, 1888 to 1918, to tell a personal story which illuminates two worlds. Edwardian Oxford, just before 1914, is one of these, and this year, 100 years on, of course, the cataclysm of the Great War would claim the lives of so many of the Oxford generation of that time, and they are never far from our minds. I'm incredibly fortunate in the survival of Reggie's incomparable archive, which includes his letters from France in 1917 and 18, now here in the college library, letters between Reggie and my grandmother, Claire Howard, when they fell in love in 1912, a photograph album also, which you will see things from, which my parents gave to the library here in Merton many years ago, and most recently discovered the minutes of the Myrmidon Club, which, as it turns out, my grandfather was the secretary of in the last year he was here in Merton. Well, I knew nothing at all of this abundance of material when I discovered Reggie's signature with many others of previous occupants of the room in Front Quad I lived in the second year I was here at Merton, 1960. So I lived in my grandfather's room in the college. His serious portrait, seen here, has stood over me in a sense and looked down on me all through my childhood, the portrait in khaki, as you'll see. And he lives now in the abundance of letters and images which I own and have now given to the college, and of course also, very importantly, with the 108 other Mertonians, including six college servants, we should note, whose sacrifice we honour, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. The war memorial under the Fitzjames Arch, expressing the equality of sacrifice and not recording the ranks, but recording simply the regiments of those who died from the college. Reggie was born in March 1888, just 2 years after the death of his grandfather, a great Victorian churchman who, as Dean of Westminster, wrote patriotic verse during the Crimea about service and sacrifice. His father had followed the Dean into the church. He was then vicar of Pewbrook near Manchester, a suburb of Liverpool, and Reggie's boyhood continued at Orpington in Kent when the family moved south. The family grew up in the vicarage there from 1892 to 1898. He was still at his prep school, Gore Court in Kent, when his father died of consumption at an early age in May 1900. This little boy's passion for collecting moths and butterflies was evident in some of his early letters, one or two of which have survived. Here, in one of 1899, he writes to his cousin Ethel about how one boy here got a death's head chrysalis, and a few days after I got a hummingbird, hawk moth. These two, Ethel, who I knew very well as a schoolboy myself, and Reggie had played together on their family and near their family home in Scotland. The death of his father, just before he entered Charterhouse, is detectable, I think, in the shy look which picks Reggie out in an early photograph there, with his watch chain in his pocket. But teenage holidays in Ireland, visiting family homes of relatives in the Protestant ascendancy there, like Lawton at Moneygall, were exciting teenage days. So was winter sports in Switzerland, where his mother took his sisters to live in her early widowhood, just before he went to Merton. Reggie was still, though, when he went to Ireland in 1906, just before coming to Merton, very much the quintessential English romantic. He copied out these verses from Country Life, which touched his mood. The low-toned laughter of English girls with cheeks like peaches and teeth like pearls, the witching laughter of English girls. With only a moderate Charterhouse record, Reggie was cramming at that time to get through the matriculation exams, Latin plus others in Greek, arithmetic and algebra. His elder brother was a budding engineer who'd gone to Woolwich for an army career, but Reggie had set his heart on Oxford. He failed his responsions the first time, just scraping entry in October 1906. "I crave Merton," his mother wrote to his sister, anxious he might lose his first choice. Its actual bliss, of course, is best portrayed for us by Warden Muir, Geoffrey Muir, a Rowing Blue of the period 1912 to 1914, who explained Merton's delights, and I quote him here, "to have one's own rooms and one's own scout, who would serve them there with breakfast, luncheon, and even cold supper, to form much easier and franker friendships than one had at school, to deal no longer with schoolmasters, who, however benevolent, symbolised in the first place discipline, but with dons, whose aim was," I quote Geoffrey Muir here, "to stimulate rather than to drill, to advise rather than to admonish." The 21, and there were only 21, Merton freshmen in 1906 included two men who became special friends of Reggie's. Robert Jesson, who you see here, shared a flat with Reggie afterwards in Chelsea when they were both starting on their professional and public life. Jesson just missed blues in rugby and cricket. He became a major in the 5th Wiltshire Regiment. Walter Wood, seen here, Reggie's best man, as it turned out, at his wedding. He later edited the history of the King's Shropshire Light Infantry in the First War. He was a Japanese prisoner of war in 1941-5, and he lived, I'm amazed to discover, until 1962, the year that I graduated at Oxford. There were two others who had come up in 2005 with Reggie, who struck up immediate and close friendships. One of them, who we know a lot about, was Edward Burney. Eddie was the first of his Merton friends to go to France on August the 13th, 1914, when on a madcap jaunt with Reggie's younger brother Herbert, they crossed the Channel with a motor bicycle and obtained a pass, which amazingly we still have, from the mayor of Calais to be allowed to travel inland towards the British Expeditionary Force, which was then near Amiens. And Eddie was then a budding journalist, and he wanted a scoop. But it was probably Guy who encouraged Reggie to take up rowing, which he did that autumn, and he made the Torpids crew in 1907. He stands next to Guy, sporting a watch chain over his waistcoat. Reggie's photos of the boathouses and the crowds on the river convey with a marvellous immediacy the atmosphere of training on the river in Edwardian times for Edwardian Torpids. A Mertonian whose records we have here in the library, William Cushing, described the river, 40 or more toggers, all practicing at once. The towpath was jammed. People are constantly falling in, and boats constantly collided. We are given much larger meals than the rest of the college, he noted. Reggie was again in the college's Torpids crew in 1909, his final year. These are the pictures we have of the river. Well, a letter, I don't have many letters, but I do have one or two letters that Reggie wrote while he was at Merton. This one to his sister Margot on the 22nd November 1908, bubbles with his thrilling third year. His tutor had told him he was fairly hopeful about the coming exams. He dined, he said, with the senior tutor before going to a great dance last week. He'd taken in a girl from Margot's school. I forget her name, though she was very nice. At 12:02, he explained, and I quote again from this letter, a great change comes over the room as 90% of the men start running, hatless and coatless, away to get in by midnight. It's rather amusing, he assured his sister. The Christmas balls were soon beginning, one at Coombe Park, another with the Stapleton family. Did their mother know anything about a Strothmeyer piano? This is what he was looking for the Myrmidon Club, for their rooms at number 104 in the High Street. And they hoped to buy it on what he called the gradual payment scheme. Soon his years in this gilded world would be over. Reggie was going to have a high old time before he went down. With his appointment as honorary secretary of the Myrmidon Club, Reggie knew that in the Society of Merton he had arrived. Here was the famous jacket of the Myrmidon members. 14 pages of the minutes of this period cover the period January to July 1909, and they tell of some of the best days of the Myrmidon Club. At the core were Beach, who we met already, Burney, Wood and Jesson, a clique of Reggie's special friends. This excessive social life of the undergraduate elite, reputed, of course, for its hard drinking, an obsession too with club rules and its sheer revelry, is all here in these minutes that Reggie kept over a period of nearly 6 months. William Cushing, an American in Oxford in 1908-09, confirms Reggie's account, portraying the culture of the Myrmidons and the college in his letters home. About 12 men a year, he explained, and remember, each year was quite small, so there was quite a big proportion of the Merton years of that time, were chosen to join this special college's premier club. The best men, said Cushing, in the college, by all odds, not simply for their sociability, but their achievements. Some of the meetings, he said, end very riotously, with sponging port and cigarettes from their friends. Soaking up the Myrmidon leadership of the college's life, Cushing concluded, almost all the talk he heard was of tales of binges past and present and rowing prospects. Well, at a Myrmidon business meeting in Reggie's rooms on the 18th of January, 1909, the president reiterated the secrecy of the club's proceedings. Reggie, as secretary, noted the breakages of glass the previous term, proposed that hosts in future should pay on their own bills for these breakages. Wood was fined on this occasion 5 shillings for being 17 minutes late for the meeting. A committee took charge of the social programme. The junior proctor gave permission for a dinner, so long as he received the names of those attending and that it finished by 11:15. 22 members, including some guests, we're told from Reggie's minutes, attended in the club rooms on the 23rd of January. The president gave us a song, Reggie records in the minutes. His guest contributed a more popular or sentimental one, in which, I quote his minutes, the hero announced repeatedly he was afraid to go home in the dark. A second dinner was held on the 6th of March in the club's rooms. Reggie noted the steward's unacceptable delay with the suite and then the cup. Noise increasing, he narrated, most men preferred falling about the room, till a guest let a bronze vase slip. Remember, these rooms were in the High Street, over the pavement of the high. He let this vase slip. It fell through the window onto the High Street pavement. Two bridge fours then settled down to play, bringing back some order, but the broken vase cost a member £1 fine, a deeply regrettable slur on the club in Reggie's eyes. Well, the Edwardian myrmidons were well aware of the Victorian tradition of clubs in Oxford, which included the competitive athletic challenges between rival college clubs. Reggie pasted this extract from the Tatler about some of these clubs into the Myrmidons minute book, mentioning, for instance, the Rousers of the House, prefiguring the Bullingdon Club, Trinity's Claret Club, and Brasenose's Vampires. Well, the college grind, a combative steeplechase held across open fields near Oxford, was particularly prized in this male Oxford environment of undergraduates. The grind, as it was called — it took me some looking in dictionaries to find out what a grind was, but there it is in the Oxford Dictionary, used in Oxford only — was a steeplechase across these fields, and the Merton Challenge in 1909 was the College Exeter, of a steeplechasing rival of the year before. There was a sufficient lunch, minuted Reggie in the minutes, and some good running. The magnificent sight, you have it here, of the coach and four, hired by Merton, with 10 runners, well wrapped — of course it's still winter when this was taken, I think — well wrapped up on top, ready in the High Street for departure, is a memorable sight. Well, then, discovering that 50 years previously the Myrmidons met the Brasenose Vampires for an annual cricket match, Reggie had the club revive this problem. The day was arranged, the 1st of June. This is the invitation. But it turned out to be pouring with rain, making cricket out of the question. But lunch in the club rooms, Reggie recorded, I quote, passed off very merrily. There being more noise than at many meetings. Led by their presidents, the Vampires and the Myrmidons drank each other's health, of course. After some music, the whole party took taxis to Sandford, where, we're told, tea and amusement was found at the King's Arms. The junior proctor took notice of rowdy behaviour, for which the club was duly fined £1 that day. Some had thrown missiles, it seems, at passers-by in the High Street. Reggie, as secretary, paid the fine from the club's funds, regarding it as eminently just. A decision was formally taken on the 16th of June for the club's annual photo to be taken in ordinary clothes instead of the evening dress that the club had for special occasions. And here is this 1909 photograph of the club members. Reggie and his friend Guy Beach are sporting boaters, you'll see in the middle there, in the second row, I think. The term ended in style, with 150 people, we're told, attending the club's dance in June, in the assembly rooms of the town hall. In Reggie's closing minutes for the club, he and his friends ended their Oxford careers, he noted, in triumphant style. I quote, the senior tutor and the domestic bursar brought parties, the band was good, the floor perfect, and the catering excellent. After the dance, we're told, many members supped in a certain room, we're not told which room, in Mob Quad. The proceedings had to be very quiet by special request of the principal of the postmasters. But as Reggie tells us, this was not quite the end. Early on Saturday morning, and I quote the minutes, some members found it too late to go to bed. So an adjournment was made via a window and punts to Sandford down the river for breakfast. At a business meeting that week, new officers were elected. There were a crowd of nominations. The American W.J. Cushing achieved the pinnacle of his career by being elected to the Myrmidons. Sending home the news, he sighed with relief. "I thought the drinkers in my year would be elected," he said. Reggie reckoned, turning this minute into a personal farewell, that the last meeting on the 17th of June, with speeches, songs and full choruses, capped his whole Merton life, as he said, the best evening of any in the last 2 years. One particular photograph in Reggie's album summarises this whole golden Edwardian world. The college's commemoration ball in 1908. It was about then that Reggie introduced his friend Primrose Barstow to Geoffrey Cheshire, later a fellow of the college, and their son became Group Captain Cheshire VC, who you will all know of, I'm sure. But there is another side to Reggie's Merton life which we must not ignore. In the Trench family, children were reared on poetry and serious reading. Reggie's grandfather's poetry at the time of Crimea appeared in the Times. At Christmas in 1905, he acquired an edition of The Hive, a selection of poems, Coleridge, Byron, Southey, Shelley, Sir Walter Scott and Wordsworth were all there. At 17, he bought in a Morven bookshop Darwin's Origin of the Species. At Florence on holiday in 1906, just before he came up to Merton, Reggie's sisters, Cesca and Margot, bought him a handsome leather-bound edition of Tennyson's poems, all these various books I'm fortunate enough now to own. At Oxford, Reggie was an inveterate visitor to Thornton's bookshop, some of us remember it, in the High Street. He normally went to buy the latest book by Rudyard Kipling, forking out the money for the superior red leather-bound editions. His collection of a dozen of these Kipling books graced my grandmother's drawing room table, and one of my very first memories was these books on that table. And their importance puzzled me as a child. But one of them, I now at last find, was a present to Reggie from his friend at Merton, Guy Beach. So Reggie and his friend shared a literary culture that was at the heart of the private life they lived in their Merton rooms, a life of drinking, reading, aloud sometimes, and debating every aspect of life's possibilities. It was in memory of this vivid Oxford experience that 2 years after it was over, Guy Beach, his signature there, sent Reggie, as a Christmas present in 1912, a treasury of prose and poetry. So how does this reading matter connect with the youthful patriotism that was forming in these young men's minds, ready, though they knew it not, for 1914? The connection, I believe, is absolutely crucial. Here we see again Guy Beach, one of the Merton group who went into the war together. Reggie's favourite Kipling story, though, was a book called The Brushwood Boy, a destiny tale about a youngster's fulfilment in both romantic love and service to the nation. The plot developed around George Cottar's meetings, always started at a pile of brushwood stacked near a beach with the girl who became the love of his life. In his dreams, they rode the 30-mile ride together. Cottar is portrayed as modest, gallant and diligent. "I envy the knights of old time who could perform deeds of daring do for their loves," Reggie wrote in one of his letters to Claire during their engagement in 1913. So Reggie, as many others then, grew up on Kipling's Sussex tales. They evoke a Wealden landscape that he knew well, Pucker Pook's Hill and Rewards and Fairies were historical fantasy stories full of adventure. Kipling told of the continuity of land and people, of the English as an island race strong in custom and tradition. Appropriately, Kipling was the J.R.R. Tolkien of his time. In Rewards and Fairies, Reggie found the original version, only just published then, of the famous poem If. He said, writing to his fiancée, that it was jolly inspiring. He sent the book to her as a birthday present. It was the sheer impossibility of achieving all Kipling's counsels of perfection that inspired Reggie. Charles Carrington, in The Great War, writing the biography of Kipling later, declared that there was nothing more effective in moulding the thought of a generation than the passages in Pucker Pook's Hill about the defence given by the Roman centurion Parnesius against the winged hats on the Roman wall. I think we cannot begin to understand the Great War without taking full account of this whole chivalric tradition, learnt among others by Reggie, Guy Beach and their circle of friends here in Merton's rooms. Well, Reggie took a pass degree and settled into a Chelsea flat with Robert Jesson, who we've seen before, becoming a commuter for his chartered accountancy articles with Deloitte, Plender and Griffiths in the city. He probably hoped that his uncle Benny, a partner in a successful stockbroking firm, might ease his career path. Before 1909 had ended, he joined the Inns of Court Officers Training Corps, where keen attendance at summer camps ensured his rapid promotion. It was typical of him also that in February 1911 he bought Francis Galton's book, Inquiries into the Human Faculty and Its Development, for eugenics was then all the rage among these young men in his circle. Far more dramatically, it was in July 1911, just 2 years after the memorable last days at Merton, that Reggie fell in love. He began a secret courtship with Claire Howard. He sought to marry his childhood girlfriend next door, the youngest of 10 children at Barkhart in Orpington, children of the barrister Henry Howard. Reggie and Claire, after some distance and some time growing up, because he was quite a lot older than her, met again, both now adults, at her coming out dance in July 2011. Small and buxom, Claire was a sporty girl of 18, not long out of boarding school, where she had been captain of hockey. During their secret engagement, July 1912 to the following July, Reggie and Claire were in youthful bliss. In the summer of 1913, they camped in Devon with friends together. And here we see a typical, if you like, Edwardian teenager's camp on the River Dart. Reggie confessed his nervousness to his prospective wife, as he hoped, realising how little money he'd got straight out of Oxford. "How little I'm earning and am likely to earn for a year or two. £105 now, which is not only a pretty miserable amount for a varsity man, 24 years of age, but a poor sort of amount to produce to anyone who should ask that I can provide for Claire." But at their joy camp, shown here, as these youngsters called it, by the River Dart, the future remained uncertain. Reggie did find the courage to approach Henry Howard after consultation with family elder statesmen the next summer. Immediately he had passed his final accountancy exams. His mother, he believed, would chip in, and he decided to ask his prospective father-in-law for another £200 a year. Listening to all these figures, Henry Howard of Barkhart gave his blessing to the marriage on the 15th of July, 1914. But by then, an archduke had been assassinated in Sarajevo. Reggie and Claire's 1914 correspondence, which I have many, many letters of, brings home the shock and disruption to young people's lives created by the outbreak of war. An alert young man, Reggie, explained the situation as best he could to Claire, as the story has been told many times since, when he was just off to his annual camp on Salisbury Plain on the 30th of July. Germany's preparedness was the key issue, and he wrote as follows: "If they come in, we do inevitably, I think, and we must remember that we would not then be fighting for any abstract Serbian reason, but rather to prevent France being overwhelmed and to protect the neutrality of Belgium and Holland, which are of enormous importance to us as regards Germany." He met her panic about his going to fight by reasoning that with his administrative record in the OTC and his summer camps, he would be kept at home, as he said, to drill and instruct recruits. Their letters show how immediately this was a family war. Claire saw her brother off at a station in early August. She at once enrolled herself as a voluntary aid detachment nurse. She was soon dressing the wounds of Belgian and British soldiers in the makeshift hospital in the village hall of her home village of Orpington. She kept an autograph book which has survived and asked some of her patients to tell their war stories, and here is one of them, told on this scrap of paper. "We shall have a good deal of casualties before we go through with this show, I'm afraid," Reggie wrote to her at this time. Reggie was now growing the moustache she had begun, almost in premonition in July. Visiting Claire, the chauffeur and his wife spotted him and at once asked for a photograph. They were impressed, they told Claire, by his, I quote, martial bearing, and pleased he had what they called the right soldier stamp. Thus we see the depth of the transformation of young men who, carefree undergraduates, had so recently left Merton behind. They were suddenly wholly in the grip of their patriotic duty. That September, Reggie sent Claire a leather-bound edition of Sir Henry Newbolt's poems. They were another formative influence on them both. In 1912, he had confessed in a letter to Claire, they made him a mere city clerk, feel rather a slacker. In his Clifton Chapel, one of Newbolt's most famous poems, he made the crucial connections in the notion of patriotic manliness between the soldier's mind, his body, and his emotions. To set the cause above renown, to love the game beyond the prize, to honour while you strike him down the foe that comes with fearless eyes, to count the life of battle good and dear the land that gave you birth, and dearer yet the brotherhood that binds the brave of all the earth. Claire commented to Reggie on how exactly Newbolt's poems at this time fitted, as she put it, with one's present mood and the general atmosphere. Well, Reggie was correct in his estimate of what he would at first be asked to do with regard to officer training. He spent the first 18 months of the war with the Inns of Court Training Corps at Berkhamsted, where he was quickly promoted to captain. His drive and energy shines through, a mass of letters he wrote then survive. He found it invidious selecting from his company those to be commissioned at once. The others left looked so miserable, he says in a letter to Claire. He made light of the wound sustained by a neighbour in his Chelsea street. A bullet in his head just where the hair starts. A near thing, he commented, stressing the sheer excitement that this heroic return brought to the inhabitants of Tedworth Gardens in Chelsea. Lists of the wounded became everyday reading. "He is such a vipper, I hope he comes out all right," he told Claire, noting the name of a particular friend listed as seriously wounded. He explained to Claire that the next category after seriously wounded was dangerously wounded. But Reggie's most conscientious correspondent that autumn was Eddie Burney, his Merton friend. Reggie was pleased he got the job he wanted as a dispatch motorbike rider. "I had a ripping letter," he rated on the 14th of October. "He's not had any great adventures yet." It was a different story with the next letter, one of the most valuable documents in all my Great War papers. Here it is. You will see it is a long letter, inscribed at the top with these words: "War is an abomination." Eddie's intimate reflections are moving. We know how close friends the two had been at Merton. I will quote some passages of the letter, which you can't really read for yourselves. "I've received," Eddie wrote, "several baptisms of fire. To be quite strictly accurate, I've been about half a dozen times in villages or roads which have been under shell fire, and I've had bullets whizzing past me several times in quite sufficient numbers to make me uncomfortable. I came on a heap of 10 French territorials just after they'd been laid out by Jack Johnson, which was a disagreeable sight. Needless to say," writes Reggie, "I'm no fire eater and dislike these experiences heartily, but I feel just a little less of the very raw civilian now. 2 days ago, I was motorbiking along a road in search of information. Suddenly, to my alarm, a German head popped up from a hole in the ground. I realised that all the Germans, there were a good many of them, were dead or wounded. Two or three of the poor men groaned to me for water and said they'd been lying there 3 days without anything at all to eat or drink. I gave them some morphine. Motorbiking along the roads here in Belgium is almost impossible, and after rain becomes completely so. I've been over 3 times in the last 2 days. This pencil was taken from a German prisoner. Thrilling realities of war! Exclamation mark. It is an interesting sight into the momentous times that Eddie scrawled on this letter that I've shown you here. Please keep this scrawl. Eddie's next missive in December had a quieter tone. When he came home on a few days' leave, he and Reggie were able to meet. Reggie also managed to keep in quite close touch at this time with Guy Beach. Yet it is hard for us to grasp how, for this generation of young Mertonians, the community and pleasures of Oxford must have quickly become a distant but sacred memory. The war was scattering them. They were having to grow up very fast indeed, much faster than any of them could have expected. Military effort became totally absorbing for men like this in the last months of 1914. People like Reggie needed fan mail, and he kept some of it. A.J. Wilmer wrote in January 1915 to Reggie when he moved on to the Staff College at Camberley after working with Reggie at Berkhamsted. "All this is probably quite bad form," he declared, momentarily dropping his stiff upper lip, "but I do want you to know how much I feel I owe you. The Inns of Court training," we've got some pictures of it here, "stressed practising command and emphasis on the moral qualities needed in those who would have to lead men in the field. In the entrenchment practice at Berkhamsted, men learnt about digging and revetment." Briefly, though, there was a wartime honeymoon for Reggie and Claire. From the 28th of January 1915, their delayed marriage at last took place. Notice the khaki in this picture, with Walter Wood, who we have seen earlier at Merton, as Reggie's best man, and his younger brother Herbert on the right-hand side in a trench coat. Amazingly, the dinner napkin, a very precious survival, has survived in my family archive. It summarizes the wedding dinner and the love affair which was brought to fruition just as the war was taking hold of the minds of the whole nation. Well, during 1915, as with so many young men, Reggie was aching to get to the front. But his commanding officer kept him back because he was doing good work in training officers at Berkhamsted. He joined the Sherwood Foresters in early 1916, believing that they were the next regiment about to go to France. But instead, with extraordinary irony, his battalion was sent to Dublin in early May to help put down the Easter Rising. His mother was living there with Reggie's sister, Cheska, who was a dedicated Sinn Féiner and who had taken messages, in fact, to the General Post Office the year before during the Rising. She was not, as it happens, arrested. Cheska's brief reference to Reggie visiting the family home in May is silent on the tensions that must have been felt. Family unity was having to overcome total political division. Tuesday the 9th of May 1916, runs her diary, Reggie came on Sunday when we were eating breakfast. He was amiable and good-tempered and good-spirited and stayed the night. For Reggie, of course, relished the active soldiering he began to experience, which this image shows us a picture of. He is with his fellow officers on Salisbury Plain before departure in February 1916. The war began for him, commanding D Company of the 2nd 5th Sherwood Foresters, with a month of marching and billeting from Le Havre to the front. Reggie therefore learnt the devastation of war before the tumult of battle, since the German army had retreated from the Somme battlefield, which he had to cross now, to the Hindenburg line. This was when he first understood the comfort to be found in receiving letters and writing daily letters to Claire and every fortnight or so to his mother, Isabel Trench, as well. This letter on the 16th of May to Isabel is written over in ink by her, as all his letters to her were after his death. He has attached a poppy to it, with its tiny strips of sellotape still visible in this image. He's reporting on an officer's trip to Amiens, and I'll read a small section of it. "We were all in the greatest spirits, you see. The majority of us had never not seen a civilian for 9 weeks, and a decent shop for 3 months. We went through the ruined zone, seeing it gradually wake to life. We passed through villages and saw all the men troop out of their cellars and billets to the ablution benches. Another lot were having their brekker, another lot at drill. We finally came to the old British and German lines from the period of the Somme. I was surprised to see there grass growing quite fresh between the old lines. I thought the ground would be quite blasted with the tempests of iron and explosives that swept it for so many months." Well, Reggie quickly learnt that the essence of care for his men was getting them decently billeted and properly fed. This sketch, he sent a number of these in a letter to Claire, shows his cubbyhole bed as officer commanding his company, the forms round a table for his fellow officers, servants' quarters and the kitchen. Well, this was, of course, a supremely macho world, yet middle-class young men applied the models, I think, of their own homes in effectively taking on parenting roles to younger soldiers. Finding a youth with toothache, Reggie improvised. He wrote home as follows: "I got the lid of a tin, filled it with hot tea, told him it had laudanum in it, and had him, his finger dipped in it, massage the gum. Faith and a little eye wash helps a lot with the lads," he wrote home. He was triumphant about the bath he fixed up on this march across France. borrowing a huge tarpaulin, he had water carried in petrol tins from the nearby field kitchen. "We put 100 men through so far, he related. He was also thrilled by his invention of, as he reckoned, a virtually fly-proof latrine. Well, Michael Roper, in his book The Secret Battle, which is about emotional survival in the Great War, published in 2009, he used quite a few of Reggie's letters, and he attributes his effectiveness as a junior officer to the period of territorial training that I've mentioned. Because in those years after Oxford, summer camps gave him and men like him a close knowledge, as Roper puts it, of how to manage the domestic routines of soldiering. So perhaps it was not completely untypical that he was able to manage these kind of domestic aspects of the war himself. Also, becoming a family man was important, since he heard regularly about the trials and tribulations of bringing up my mother Dell, born in November 1915, while he was writing back about feeding, the health and the hygiene of his men. Most telling was the distinction Reggie made in one letter to Isabel about love and trust. "No, you're quite wrong," he wrote to his mother. "The men do not love or even like me, but I think they will follow me. Very few men, and I'm not one of them, can keep good discipline and popularity. I think I have the first, but I know I have not got the second." Officer camaraderie, meanwhile, meant a great deal to Reggie, as we shall see from some dinner menus which have survived among his papers sent home. He rather liked sending these dinner menus home. And he was particularly pleased with this one, drawn by a colleague for a battalion dinner in August 1917. When he hosted a brigade dinner in October, the decorated menu ended up with the signatures of his senior officers. Here was evidence for Clare that the war was not all leading wiring parties or making domestic arrangements. War was, of course, mainly routine, not battle. Reggie's description of sentry duty at Flesquières was almost lyrical. "Many times at dawn," he explained, "he had watched the ground before that hilltop village. I quote him, first one could see our barbed wire, then our posts crawling back to our line, then the Boche trench, then the roof of Ribécourt, finally Flesquières village, growing clearer every minute." Well, it did come after some while, of course, of getting used to being in the trenches and on the Western Front, for the 2nd and 5th Foresters, Sherwood Foresters, to be expected to go into battle. And this was on the 4th of April 1917, when their assignment was to capture the village of Le Verguier on the Hindenburg line. Reggie led three companies. He was saved, and they were saved, or many of them, by a snowstorm, which, blinding the German guns, allowed a retreat. There were, in fact, 104 casualties in his battalion, including 20 men who were killed. "I'm thankful to say," Reggie wrote home the next day, "my nerves under fire were perfect. This is very comforting, as one's responsibilities are very great." He felt his men had passed a crucial test of morale. The men were splendid, laughing all the time at their escapes and following their officers perfectly. But his wife, Claire, nagged. 3 weeks, 3 whole weeks, and 14 letters later, he came clean about his actual experience of this battle. He had, in fact, been just a couple of yards from Captain Adams when he was wounded. I quote from the letter he wrote some weeks later, "He died shortly after, I believe, though I had advanced and did not know till later." When the battalion moved on to Passchendaele, it was again in action, but Reggie, now second in command of the battalion, was kept in reserve. Then he took over and was responsible for the battalion's long 3-day march to spend the winter in the line further south at Novaï. Here is the official battalion Christmas card for 1917, which he sent home to my mother Doe. His first leave came in July 1917, when he enjoyed time on the beach at Charmouth in Dorset. As so many must have felt, leave was over unbearably quickly. I feel I can hardly realise I was ever lying on the beach with you and Dell, or undressing with you on that grass under the cliff. Summarised Claire later, it's a lovely dream. In the case of his second leave, I have his railway ticket, or the first half of it, from France to Twyford in Berkshire, where he stayed with his aunt and uncle. Married in wartime, Reggie and Claire had never been able, of course, to have a house or a home of their own. But he brought home at Christmas that year, for his mother, a little paper knife made by one of his pioneers using a Bosch cartridge case and a piece of brass shell case. His account after this second leave in January 1918, we can say, was rather clipped, concealing massive emotion. We had a jolly time together. It gets harder every time to say goodbye. Erich Ludendorff's offensive strategy to break the Allied line in March 1918 was focused on 50 miles of the Western Front, with 72 divisions facing an outnumbered 26 British divisions. On the fine, dry night of March the 20th, the German bombardment began at 4:40 a.m. Reggie wrote to Claire just before 7 a.m. in his headquarters dugout. It would be a bore if the cookhouse just above him got a direct hit, he wrote. He would have a shave while I can. Ever your ownest, Reg. Before 10 o'clock, the 2nd and 5th Sherwood Foresters faced the full might of a German attack, and Reggie led the resistance. After being wounded in his left arm and shoulder, his last stand lasted about an hour. Tommies recalled him in bandages and smoking his pipe. The best account of his death in battle is by drummer Field. Jerry was all around us, and we found our ammunition was giving out. Time after time I saw Major Trench bring up case after case. The next time I saw him, he was on top, which was certain death, with bandages round his head and a sling for his arm, still bringing ammunition up. I think it was a brilliant death. It will certainly bring comfort to his people to know that he died like that. Reggie's batman saw that his body was made safe from shell fire inside the HQ dugout. The Germans later notified Claire that he was buried nearby there. And I now have a rather poor picture, but it's a picture of the site that I'm talking about, which my brother and I visited some years ago on a bend in the road near a French village, and Claire visited that site in August 1919 and wrote to her mother-in-law about what she found. And this is part of her letter. She says, "We found Novaï a sad heap of ruins, as you see, and the battalion headquarters as Reg described to me. The latter with a shelter for the cookhouse and stores on the top, and the deep dugout below, with which he usually had, unusually had easy steps going down to it. It was, of course, strange seeing it all." Well, when I visited the site, go back to that wonderful picture many years later, it was interesting to see that the French farmers had ploughed right up to this bend in the road where the headquarters dugout was, but they'd not tried to plough into in front of those trees there. So what we have here is a First World War dugout, headquarters dugout of a battalion which has never been excavated, as there must be many such dugouts, of course. Reggie gave tributes, colleagues gave tributes to Reggie as a soldier. Captain Burrows told Claire how delighted I was with his welcome when I joined the battalion and felt very raw and young. I simply can't tell you what we thought of him, declared Captain Rossiter. We all loved him. Major Pratt admired his knowledge and fine handling, as he put it, of men. A close friend, Captain Stebbing, noted he never spared himself any amount of trouble to ensure we were all looked after well. But the most interesting account of Reggie from this military phase of his life, I think, comes from the book The Green Triangle, which is the battalion history published in 1920, the 2nd, 5th Sherwood Foresters. And it reads, Reggie was not a comfortable man with whom to share a dugout. His personality was too big, his vitality and enthusiasm for work filled the atmosphere. The book spoke of his enormous gifts for organisation. Friends in the Mermaid Club, who respected his energy as secretary there, would have understood this tribute. But Merton friends also knew the sense of a fellow soldier's comment that, with all his practicality, he had a mystic strain in him, probably due to his Irish origin. Reggie was first reported missing, his death only being confirmed a few weeks later, on March the 21st. The condolence archive, now in the college library here, I think may be one of the largest surviving private archives that we have for a single soldier killed in battle in the Great War that we have surviving. It's huge because there are two lots of letters. There are letters to Reggie's wife, Claire, but also to his mother, Isabel. Needless to say, it's invaluable as a source of our understanding of the ideology within which the Great War was fought. And I've used it in my book, Life, Death and Growing Up on the Western Front, for that purpose. And another historian, Jessica Mayer, when she worked on her book Men of War, Masculinity and the First World War, used these letters also. I shall focus, as Jessica Mayer did too, on some of the letters which deal with the notions of duty and sacrifice, which with inspiring the vast community of national mourners of this time. But I shall also have something special to say about the precious letters we have from those I've spoken of in this lecture as his Merton circle. There were those, of course, who were only known to the man who died to Reggie as a soldier. There were family members, some remembering as a child. Others, again, who knew him through chance acquaintanceship, but not personally at all. The view of those writing from many different perspectives allows us some insight into how a few people, at least, were feeling generally in their hearts about the war after it had been going on by this time for such a long time. The Trench and Howard families naturally closed ranks in their loss. Claire's sister Violet wrote from East Africa, I do feel tremendously that his life was so tremendously worthwhile. Our very best are taken from us, lamented Claire's sister-in-law, Dorothy Hart. The thought of his high character and conviction would help sustain her, Aunt Francie wrote. The grief of his childhood playmate and relative, Ethel Gorbus, who you remember I mentioned earlier and to whom I have a letter, ran deep. Reggie had lived so gloriously and died so gloriously. The world will be poorer for his going on, but just now we need his sort so much. She lived with the memory of his beautiful, upright, loyal character. His teenage friend and Merton Commemball partner, Primrose Barstow, had happy memories of their holidays in Switzerland. I cannot say how shocked I am, recalling him as a splendid companion. Senior family members were some of the most reflective, coming from the generation in which the whole language of sacrifice, drawing upon classical chivalric models, reached its apogee. Reginald Copleston, who had married the couple in 1915, noted that he seems to have been called away in the supreme moment of rededication of himself. Just returned, was he not, after the dressing of his wound, to the high places of the field? What could be nobler? This was a death in the very moment of reconsecration. Uncle Benny remembered he told his sister Isabel, Reggie's chucking a soft job, but he could have retained with honour to make the greatest sacrifice a man can make. The condolence archive brings to light unexpected insights into the community of mourning as a whole, which linked this family to other families who lost loved ones during the war. "Personally, we are entire strangers," wrote William Swan to Clare, "and yet in a sort of kinship of trouble, we do not quite feel that to be so." His son Willie had often spoken of her husband, and they were, it seems, good friends. The Swan family had so much appreciated a personal letter when Willie was killed. Isabel Davies had a son killed in battle who had evidently worked close by to Reggie. It was therefore remarkably nice of him to have written, and we greatly valued his kind sympathy. Maud Aliban felt a powerful bond with Reggie through his efforts to recover her son's body after the battalion's battle at Malakoff Farm in 1917. Reggie was killed a year later, and she was still suffering from anxiety about whether her young William had died quickly or had lain wounded on the battlefield. She was glad Reggie's end had been virtually instantaneous. "He loved my boys," she told Clare. "Now they are together again." She arranged a special communion in her Derbyshire village when she heard the news that Reggie had fallen, with the hymns "God Moves in a Mysterious Way" and Tennyson's "Crossing the Bar." There was a sense in early 1918 that this was now a titanic struggle which might be unending. An Orpington friend of the family, noting Reggie's passing, referred to the great cause of righteousness. It was, he declared, a wholly Christ-like thing to suffer and to die for others. As the national community held its breath in these last months of the war, the fallen, I think, were coming to be seen as in a real sense the chosen ones. Returning letters sent to her about Reggie's last stand, Josie Carson told his mother Isabel that her heart should be filled with thankfulness that to your son was given the high honour of acting as a hero and leaving footsteps in the sands of time. Sacrifice, I'm suggesting at this time, was seen more and more as redemptive for the nation as a whole. So what of our Merton circle of young men? Two of them were killed, Robert Jesson, Reggie's flatmate, who fought at Gallipoli and in Mesopotamia before losing his life at Kut in 1917, and then Reggie. The deep grief of Eddie Burney, Walter Wood and Guy Beach is palpable in their letters, which we have, surviving their letters of condolence. And this photograph, which I find particularly interesting, is a photograph of three of Reggie's circle, and they went up to Gilman and Soane, the best photographer in the town, to have it taken together in the midst of those years which were so formative, so memorable, were such an irreplaceable place in their young lives. Much of their talk, of course, must have been drinking and joking like light-hearted, but this, of all we do have to remember, was not Oxford in 1906 to 1909 was not an academic experience. Their Merton was not like the Merton our founder Walter de Merton envisaged. 45 years later, as an old man, Eddie Burney looked back on his undergraduate years with Reggie, still a faithful correspondent exchanging family news with my grandmother, Claire. Most of them, he said, got a third class or passed degree. None of them, beyond rowing, was much of an athlete. But a fine man, I quote him, was something rarer and bigger, he insisted. At Merton, the group formed their values for life. This brings me to the core of my argument about Edwardian Oxford and how it moulded this generation. What they thought of Reggie, their personal letters to Claire and Isabel, show rather takes one's breath away. Walter Wood was sure Reggie had been, I quote, one of the strongest influences for good in my life, and he will always remain so. I have 100 things to remember him by, the most precious being my ideal of him as a Christian gentleman. He was one of my dearest friends, Eddie wrote to Claire, a man as loyal and straight and true as ever lived. He is not one of those who have to die to be praised, he added in another letter to Reggie's mother Isabel, but even the few at Merton who constituted themselves on occasions his critics never ever dared to suggest that his conduct was anything but straight and honourable. With such loyalty, he declared, as an inspiration, my one anxiety is that I may not live unworthy of it. Guy Beach was ordained soon after graduating. He pursued a clerical career that took him to various benefices across England, eventually to a canonry at St. Albans. He wrote of Reggie in 1918, as one of the pure in heart upon whom our Lord had pronounced this blessing, upright and sincere, with a profound sense of duty, righteous in all his ways. What, though, we may pause and ask, if it had been the other way round? If Reggie had been the memorialist, writing about one or two of these others? This is speculation, but one suspects the words would have been in the same vein. Because these were all men who knew each other very well, who respected each other, thought the world of each other, delighted in each other's company. Merton, as it was then, and has remained for 100 years more or so, nurtured such intimate and lasting friendships on the very brink of adult life. It was small then. Here is the whole college in 1907. But the spirit of a place does not depend on numbers. Finally, can we go a little further, perhaps, into Reggie's mind? He did speak twice, in elevated terms, of the world war to which he gave his youthful drive, and as it turned out, his life. In November 1917, he sat down to write the letter he knew soldiers should all write, to be kept at his bank, I quote of what he wrote on the back, to be forwarded only in the case of my death. The initial statement made it clear that there was a single moment when his emotional destiny came upon him like lightning. This was when they re-met at Claire's coming out dance and knew, as he said in this letter, there was only one girl in the world for me. Largely, though, the letter was practical, explaining how he hoped Claire would be left to manage financially from various resources he knew were in place. He wanted her to buy a small house in the country where she could bring up her daughter, Dell. There were no instructions, there was simply trust. I know you will bring her up as few children have been brought up. Finally, though, Reggie turned to the cataclysm which he knew might at any moment sweep him away. He could hardly contemplate his own death, which is what everyone had to do when they wrote a letter like this, but he did manage to do so, with a final decisiveness that was perhaps typical of the person he was, placing his mortality in the huge canvas of his life and the lives of people he had known and loved. His last words to Claire were, I quote, "Well, the war is over for me, and will, I hope, soon be over for everyone. It's a bad business for the whole world." They were simple, almost unbearably drained of emotion, but they're the more memorable for that, those words. It was about the same time that Reggie enjoyed a short leave in Paris and found a copy of Henri Barbusse's classic book called Under Fire. His ecstatic letters home about this book, read rapidly cover to cover in a Paris hotel, marked achievement of an ambition. I had long been wanting to buy it, he told his wife. I saw it reviewed in some paper. Reggie found Barbusse's account of the war, as it was lived by the French poilus, wonderfully true to life. It tells the truth about the war and all its beastliness, nothing kept back, the real thing in print, he told his mother. But not a single woman should read the book. It is dreadful in places. Just lost the really important bit of the lecture, but I will find it. Yes, here we are. It is dreadful, Barbusse's book, in places, and you will not read it, my love, he wrote to Claire. If you please. He wrote it as a warning. And this, strange as it may seem, patriarchal almost command is striking, because it shows Reggie in a light I have not yet taken on board in this lecture. He was completely a man of his own times. His sense of authority over his wife tells us so much about the worlds I've been exploring in this lecture. Edwardian Oxford and the Western Front were unimaginably different worlds from our own. But in both cases, manliness was a performance, one which every man believed he had to attempt and in which men realized they could not afford to fail. These five Merton friends I've spoken of, Guy, Eddie, Walter, Robert and Reggie, tackled Oxford life with seriousness, and yet they also, I'm sure, enjoyed themselves. They were young men preparing, as they understood it, for a wholly male world. Women were there to be protected, so for those like Reggie, who'd found the love of their life, war became a crusade where they could prove themselves to others and above all to their sweetheart. Thank you.